Welcome to the bike show with me, Jack Thurston. The bike show is coming to you today from one of the most dangerous roads in the world. Well, I don't know about that, but it's certainly a road that merits an entry on the website dangerousroads.org, a website that I spend far too much time looking at. And it is called Le Passage du Gois, and it is an extraordinary 2.5 mile or 4 kilometer causeway that connects the French mainland on the Atlantic coast with the island of Noirmoutier. And I'm standing on this road, I'm standing above the road on one of the rescue towers that's been built here, because this road is only accessible twice a day for about 3 hours each time, an hour and a half each side of low tide. And it's, as you can hear, raining a little bit. Raining quite a lot. But that hasn't stopped the dozens of people who are out collecting various kinds of seafood, I suppose, from the mudflats here. They park their cars up on the sand beside the road, then march off onto what must be a kilometre at least of exposed sand and start digging. They're carrying little shovels and small rakes, and then they bring their salty treasures back to their cars in little wire baskets. And I'm here because the island of Noirmoutier in the département of the Vendée is hosting the Grand Départ of this year's Tour de France. And stage one will be starting on the island and heading south along the Atlantic coast for about 200 kilometres. And my intention is to ride that route that the pros will cover in maybe 5 hours. I will ride it over 3 days, stopping along the way to find out more about this region, to enjoy its gastronomic delights, to take a dip in the sea, and generally enjoy what is an extremely interesting part of the world. A group of touring cyclists has just, or recreational riders, has just gone past. The Tour de France had planned to cross over on stage one via this causeway route, and it's done so in 1999 when there was a big crash involving many of the leaders in the race, and also in 2011 they brought it over. But this year they had to change their plans and go over on the bridge because the tide was going to be high at the time when they planned to come across. I think it's been some kind of scheduling conflict with the World Cup in Russia, and trying to get it on TV at the right moment meant that they can't take it over here, which is a great shame, really, because it must make for an absolutely spectacular sight to see the multicoloured cavalcade of the Tour going over this this really remarkable road. I can see the bridge away to the south. It's a bridge on maybe a dozen stilts, and the bridge was built in 1971. As I understand it, before that time, this was the only way to get from the island to the mainland. About 3 hours twice a day, and you could get across. Or if you had to get across in an emergency, if you were ill or something like that, then there would be a little boat that would take you across from where the bridge is now. It must have been a funny old place to live when you were cut off from the mainland for most of the day. So I'm going to ride on into the mist and gloom under the rain clouds. I think it's due to clear up later today, and make a tour of the island, because it's an island that is perfect for cycling. I'm told there are miles of traffic-free cycle routes. The highest point on the island is 22 metres above sea level, and much of the island is actually below sea level. So it's a paradise for cyclists who want to avoid climbing any hills. I've reached the island of Noirmoutier across the causeway, and I have to say that the surface did get a little bit dicey midway across. Certainly my little Brompton wheels were feeling the bounce, and I imagine that the riders in the Tour de France this year will be breathing a sigh of relief that they won't be having to ride over there, because the gaps between some of the concrete tiles are definitely wide enough to swallow a 25 millimeter tire or send you flying if you slip on a bit of seaweed or some of the other debris that is brought in every day by the tide. And so I'm now riding on a gravel cycleway that goes around a giant polder. On the seaward side there's an enormous dike, 30 foot high, 20 foot high dike, And inside, there's a big lake, a kind of lagoon, or the polder itself, which is composed of marshes and a large amount of water, a kind of lagoony lake thing, with some islands inside. And the island is home to an enormous population of seabirds, as you can probably hear. They are roosting on these sandy islands. I guess they're flying around, maybe feeding, or just, I don't know, making their plans for the day. I don't know if this is where they overnight or this is where they come for their daily sustenance. Anyway, they're having a good chat, and I'm afraid I can't identify them for you. There are some sort of seagulls with black heads. Maybe they're black-headed gulls. I don't know. I don't want to presume to be able to identify them. There's just a lot of them, and they're making a hell of a noise. So I'm going to ride along and see what I can see further north. Oh, goodness me. Oh, goodness me. A whole lot of marsh orchids growing on the side of this track. Beautiful. I'm now about 50 feet from the main bulk of these islands where these birds are hanging out, and they're making a hell of a din. Wow, some of them are fighting each other overhead. Others are just sort of sitting and cooing away on the little islands. I'm not sure if they're all the same species. They kind of look as though they are. They've got white bodies, grey wings, and neat little black heads. Away to my left, inland a little bit, there are some cows grazing on the salt marshes. It's funny to think that just across this dike that I'm riding along, there is the sea, the open sea, or actually because it's low tide right now, it's probably just mud. I've continued my way north up the island. In fact, it's actually two islands, because Noirmoutier-en-Île is separated by some salt marshes, Marais Salants, from the rest of the island to the south. And it was possible to follow quiet lanes and gravel tracks up through those salt marshes all the way. It's an extraordinary landscape because it's worked intensively with oyster cultivation on the eastern coast, and then in the middle of the marshes, the crop that they harvest is salt. And there's a whole pattern of lagoons and little canals and salt pans where the salt water collects and is slowly evaporated by the action of the sun and the wind, and channeled through a series of, I guess, little basins in the mud. And eventually the salt makers gather it in using a long kind of scraper or spatula to bring it in piles of fleur de sel, which they then sell. It seems to be referred to as white gold here, and it's prized for its distinctive characteristics of flavour and texture. Oh, some ducks flying past over the lagoons. I'm just riding along a kind of nature reserve, which seems to be a nature reserve and a salt
harvesting area combined. There are all the way along, there are these tiny little shacks, either made out of rubble and stone or wood that's been painted with tar or creosote or something like that to be absolutely blackened. And these little shacks are selling salt in small polythene bags for anyone who wants it. And I'm headed now into the actual town of Noirmoutier-en-Île. I can see the chateau, and there's a little port with some yachts moored up. I'm standing in a car park. Well, it's not a car park, it's a parking space for motorhomes, camping car. I don't know, maybe there's 40 or 50 of them here. I guess it's a cheap place to park up if you're traveling around France in a motorhome or a caravan. But this car park, this is where the 3-week race will start. The flag will go down and the racers will roll out on the neutralized first couple of kilometres, which is actually a very scenic tour of the salt marshes. And then they'll make a turn onto the main road where the racing will begin in earnest. And that's where I'm heading now, south, because I'm following the route of the tour. But instead of following it along the main road, I'm going to be taking some of those cycle tracks alongside the road and ducking and diving in amongst the salt marshes over the bridge, and then onto the mainland, and I'm going to head south. And I'm going to head south on the coastal route, the Vélo Odyssey, which runs all the way from Brittany down to the Basque Country. And it's part of a long-distance Atlantic cycleway that I think goes all the way from Norway to Spain. Well, I've headed out of the town of Noirmoutier-en-Île on the actual route of the Tour de France, the first couple of kilometres of this year's Tour de France, and it feels a strange kind of privilege to do that. It's that thing of cycling, of road racing, that you can't very easily walk out onto the pitch at Wembley, but you can ride the route of the Tour de France. And, you know, I wish I was riding the whole route rather than just this stage, but it would probably take me all summer. This landscape is very particular, and the road twists and turns through the marshes. I wonder what the riders will make of it. There are these great salt lagoons here. I can't tell whether they're being used for production or it's a kind of nature reserve. There were a couple of salt-selling shacks, and I picked up myself a little packet of fleur de sel to take back. Not too big. I don't want to weigh myself down with bags of salt. And I passed a couple of potato fields as well. Noirmoutier is famous for its potatoes. It produces a small kind of new potato early season, a little bit like Jersey Royals, but it produces them in much smaller quantities. And they cost about 3 or 4 euros a kilogram. And there's an even more special potato called the Bonotte, which is produced in a very small quantity, and that sells for 6 or 7 euros a kilogram, or in the auctions in Paris sometimes as much as 500 euros a kilogram. I'm not sure what was going on for it to reach that price, but that is a potato that's cultivated on sandy soil with a mulch of seaweed. Rack, the kind of bladder rack, I suppose, a seaweed that they gather from the shores here, and put that over the soil as a mulch to fertilise the soil and, I suppose, impart some kind of flavour. Unfortunately, it's only available for a very short season of a week in the middle of May, and when they lift them, and it's all done by hand, no machines at all. So I better carry on. The sun is coming out. I've got a nice northerly wind blowing me along, and I hope to make some progress down the coast. My teeth are pearly, just because my hair's curly, just because I always wear a smile, like to dress up in the latest style, cause I'm glad I'm living, take my troubles all with a smile, just because my color's shady, different baby, that's why they call me shine. Well, it's puncture time. Not just puncture time, but colossal storm time. I got absolutely soaked after the sun came out. It was very strange. I cycled off the island over the big bridge and then started following the Velo Odyssey route south along the coast. Beautiful route, almost entirely traffic-free, just hugging the coastline, going in and out of the sand dunes and the forests, well away from the main road where the tour will be going, and a sort of succession of pretty seaside towns along the way, places to stop and have an ice cream. And then the sun came out and it was all feeling beautiful, and then the skies went dark, black clouds. I thought, oh, this is gonna be fine, it's gonna be fine, keep on going. And then suddenly, boom, like flushing the toilet, the clouds just emptied on top of me, and I kind of cowered behind a wall as though the rain was sort of slanting in. But now I've got a puncture, because you always get a puncture when you ride through the rain. So, and it's on the back wheel of the Brompton, which is always a bit of a fiddle to get the thing off, disengage the hub gear. Oh God. And I'll try and do this while I'm talking to you. Oh, now what? Oh dear, the thing is, I don't ride this bike very often, so I kind of forget how it works. And that goes over that. Now what do I do with this chain? Well, that may go down as the most spectacularly badly fixed puncture in the history of cycling. And I haven't even put any air into the tube to find out if it's properly fixed yet. God, well, what went wrong? Or what didn't go wrong? First of all, it seemed very, very difficult to get the tyre off the rim, to the extent that I broke one tyre lever, and then having to resort to using a screwdriver with extreme caution, which, because using a screwdriver to get a tyre off the rim is a really bad idea. But I didn't have any alternative, but I managed to snap the screwdriver as well. I finally got it off, and then the valve separated from the tube, so I can't just patch the tube and put it back in. I've had to use the spare tube, which means that I'm down to my final tube, and I hope this one doesn't go the same way. And then all manner of difficulty getting the derailleur back on, and everything lined up. So let's see if I can get some air in this thing. So pumping away with the mini pump. I'm hoping I'm ending in a town that's got a bike shop. Everywhere around here on this cycleway seems to hire bikes, so I think I'm going to be in luck. Right. Let's pack up and hope that's all okay.
Not the things you do that really hurts.
It's the morning of the second day of my ride, and last night I made it to Les Sables d'Olonne, which is a seaside resort, quite a big one, and its name literally means the sands of Olonne, and they weren't kidding when they named it. The town is built on a gigantic sand spit at the mouth of the river, and on one side is the port, and on the other side is the most enormous sandy beach. Well, the tide is right out now, so half of it's sand and the other half of it is rock pools and seaweed, but it is just enormous. Beautiful crescent-shaped curve and golden sands. The port is quite a big fishing port. In the 17th century, I've discovered, it was the centre of the French cod industry, with a big fleet that went out to the Grand Banks just off Newfoundland twice a year to bring back vast catches of cod. And they preserved it in salt, which was harvested on the salt marshes that I rode through on the way into the town. Yesterday's route, besides the storm and the puncture fest, was pretty nice. It went through a big forest, and on the other side of the forest there was a series of sandy beaches that if you took a little time off the bike, you could go for a swim. And then through the Marais Salante, which is these interesting places where there are all these tidal lagoons, and people are harvesting salt. They're still at it. It's clearly not as important an industry as it was back when salt was the main method of preserving food before the age of refrigeration. Unsurprisingly, this town has a really strong tradition in sailing, and it is the start and finish point of the Vendée Globe solo round the world yacht race, which is one of the more extreme sporting events in the world. It happens every 4 years, and I think the sailors have to go around alone, unsupported, without stopping. It's a kind of non-stop round the world yacht race. And interestingly, I saw that there's a new race starting this year called the Golden Globe, which last happened, I think, back in the 1960s. And it is a round-the-world race, another solo round-the-world race, but without any electronic equipment. So there's no GPS, no radar, no autopilot. It's just one person on a yacht and a sextant, I suppose, to navigate by the stars. It is very pleasant here. The sun is out. There's not a cloud in the sky. It feels like yesterday's rainstorms is just a distant memory. I'm all dried out after a night in a hotel. I have to say, nights in hotels are pretty nice. I'm used to sleeping in hammocks or wild camping, but I was able to wash my shorts, get cleaned up, have a good dinner and a decent breakfast, and now I'm on my way. So I'm heading south, continuing the coastal cycleway. And I just have to mention, the promenade here at Les Sables d'Olonne is an absolute marvel of public space. It's a great big wide promenade road, not unlike Brighton or Eastbourne or any number of English South Coast seaside towns. But instead of being choked with traffic, like Brighton is, there's one small lane for motor vehicles, only in one direction, a bi-directional bike lane, which is about 5 metres wide, absolutely enormous, and then vast expanses of beautifully paved footways for people to walk, chat, just enjoy the views. There's beautiful planting, wild roses, rosemary, palm trees. It's really lovely what they've done here, and it just puts what we do in Britain absolutely to shame. There's also an enormous amount of bicycle parking. I think cycling along what must be maybe a mile and a half of the promenade, I must have seen 1,000 bicycle parking stands. So clearly people do get around here by bicycle, and it's the best way to get to the beach, and the town has embraced that, and good for them.
C'est à sec, l'eau ne chante plus. C'était une fontaine, le tuyau l'a bu. Non, là y a plus d'eau, le tuyau l'a bu. C'était un ruisseau, le tuyau l'a bu. Sortez les tuyaux,
nappes phréatiques, les nappes phréatèques. Garde ta salive, ferme un peu ton bec. Le tuyau, les buses, les pompes, les bassines. Le tuyau, la buse, la boue, nos racines. Disperse nos manifs, équipe les héros, pompiers de l'Hérault, pompiers des massifs, les mêmes lances à eau pour d'autres motifs. Sortez les tuyaux, sortez les tuyaux.
Well, it's been a tough morning cycling, really tough cycling under a beautiful blue sky with just a few puffy white clouds overhead. Beside beaches, over the salt marshes, on boardwalks, over the marshes. Not 1 meter did I have to cycle with motor traffic. And so after that trauma of the last 2 hours, I've had to stop to recuperate myself. And I'm joined by Julien from the local tourist office. And where are we, Julien?
We are in Le Perret, near Le Perret. The name is for Port of La Guitière.
And I have to say, I mean, this is idyllic. It's a word that you use too much in describing places around here, but it's beautiful. It's an oyster place. It's a place where they raise oysters. And we've got two plates full of oysters in front of us, ready to eat them.
I love your description of the Port of La Guitière. We have 2 plates of oysters. We have 3 sizes of oysters. We have size 2. The big one, size 3, the medium, and size 4, the smallest. And the smallest is sweet, and the bigger is strong. We taste with white wine.
Okay, well, wait,
white wine.
Okay, well, let's pour the wine.
So it's a white wine from Talmont-Saint-Hilaire. It's a place near from here. And the cépage, it's Chardonnay from here.
So the wine has travelled a few kilometers down the river.
From a bird fly, it's like 4 kilometers from here. So we have oysters from 10 meters and white wine from 3 or 4 kilometers, bread from 2 kilometers and butter probably from 15 kilometers.
Okay, well, let's tuck in. What's the best thing?
You put your lemon.
A bit of lemon. And we are sitting right beside the estuary. We can look out and see the oyster, they're little cages really, or you call them pockets. Little plastic nets. How many years do they grow here? Is it like
3 years? They grow 3 years, and the small oysters come from the south of Vendée, and after they grow here in a little little place in Britain, between 1 and 2 years, and after they go back to Le Perret, they go back to La Guitière, to grow up and to hit in the plate.
Okay,
I love my job.
Yeah, it's a difficult job that you have this morning.
I love my job.
That's really, really, really good. There's something about being on a bicycle for a couple of hours, even though it's been really incredibly relaxing cycling this morning. that you know, to sweat a little bit gives you a hunger for exactly this kind of taste. Umami, I think they call it, don't they, in Japanese. It's a kind of salty, savoury taste, but it's deeper than just salt. And then the wine as well, which is a kind of sharp, acidic kind of taste. A perfect balance.
Avec une boulette de strass, hermaphrodite dans le sexe.
And so this place, there's maybe 4 or 5 producers. Each one has got a small shack. Oh, well, not a shack. It's like a small cabin, one story tall, with a window and where you can go in and buy or taste. And
you can.
This is a small place. It's a small production.
Yeah, it's the smallest port of oysters producers in France. For this port, Port of La Guitière, we have only 10-15 producers of oysters here.
This is a very short river, and you were telling me earlier that the river flows a few kilometres from...
15 or 20 kilometres from here.
From Talmont, so it's very clean, there's no factories upstream, and the water and the plankton that is in the water, so it's kind of, I guess, a mixture of salt water and fresh water, so it has its own distinctive ecology, and that determines the taste of the oysters we're eating now. It's not like the oysters of anywhere else. That's what you're telling me. I mean, that's amazing. So we have terroir of the sea.
Yeah, we have terroir of the sea. It's not the same because the river takes some plankton and the sea brings some plankton as well. So it's not the same taste here at the south of France or the north of France. And people like the oysters of La Guitière, and other people don't like. It's like a wine. Terroir, it's the water as well. The water comes from a terroir. And the water from here and the water from the river come from this terroir. It's a spring who give this water. But not only the spring, and the little river who come inside this river.
Sans reine de savane, long des algues, repère les appâts, rond des charnelles numéro 3. Fine de clair, belle gosse et bling bling de mer, une salopette, salmonelle, chaussée en talon corail. 7, 8, autour des cales, des plaques, quand la mer se déchaîne, c'est là-bas. Où les perles tombent du ciel, toutes seules, plus en effet, c'est là-bas. À la surface, les traits décrochés, sans les algues et sans crabe, brillant nos yeux, mon pied nous emmène, nous emmène, nous emmène.
So I've done a little bit more cycling heading south, and mostly a mixture of farmland, a bit of marsh, some of the suburbs, well, not the suburbs really, but some of the little towns, holiday towns that line the Atlantic coast of the Vendée, and through a bit of wood, which is a little bit boring going through the woods because you want to see the sea, and I've just stopped off at a beach called, I think it's Longueville-sur-Mer, or just outside Longueville-sur-Mer. And this beach is probably the longest beach I've ever seen in my life. It really stretches as far as the eye can see in either direction. And the wind's picked up, as you can probably hear, but I've just been in the water. There are some good waves to be had. The surfers are out. There seems to be a surf school on the beach here, and people are in the water jumping around. I'd kind of been bracing myself for the chill of the Atlantic that I'm used to from swimming off the coast of Cornwall and Pembrokeshire, where it is pretty chilly even in the height of summer. But here it's a few degrees warmer. Oh, and then just to come out and lie on the sand and feel the heat of the sun and the warmth of the sand. Oh, it's really, really wonderful. Heading south, the beach continues all the way to the headland, which I think is the end of my day, at La Tanche-sur-Mer, about 10 kilometres away. It's been very easy cycling. I stopped in at the house of Georges Clemenceau, who was the war leader of France at the end of the First World War. Quite an interesting place, actually. It's just a small cabin on the edge of the sea. He planted up a garden with the help of Claude Monet, the impressionist painter, who was also a very good gardener. And it's a kind of impressionist garden, really, not a formal garden at all. Just swathes of plants attempting to recreate a kind of natural look And the house inside, well, it's not really a house, it's just three or four rooms in a line, was very atmospheric. It did feel as though it was the place that he lived. There were hunting trophies on the walls, mementos of his travels in the Far East and in Africa. And it seemed to be a place to think, to enjoy the sun and the garden and the sea, and I guess to contemplate the horrors of the First World War, somehow find a way of dealing with that. Clemenceau's cabin reminded me in a strange way of the small cottage, the woodsman's cottage of Lawrence of Arabia, which you can visit on the heathland near Wareham in Dorset. And I guess it was the same sort of time after the First World War, both men having been war heroes, I suppose having to deal with the fame of that and also having to deal with their role, although they have played very different roles. I mean, Clemenceau, a very aged statesman, famously with his white moustache, the old man, the old father of France, the father who saved France and was victorious over the Germans. Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence, a much younger man whose war was in the Middle East. But they both seemed to be men of letters who had a taste for the exotic, enjoyed reading, enjoyed a simple, fairly simple life. Clemenceau's cabin, considerably bigger and grander, if a cabin can be grand, than Lawrence's. It does feel as though the weather is changing a little bit. I can't decide whether... Oh, there's a little... Was that sea spray? Or was that a bit of rain? I don't know. There are some dark clouds massing. And I think I need to complete the last 10 kilometres of today's ride before I get another soaking and I invite a visitation by the puncture fairy. Time to get some clothes on and hit the road. It's about 10 to 10. I'm on the beach. The sun is setting, or has just set, over my shoulder. It's nearly the middle of summer, isn't it? 10 to 10, sunset. What's that all about? The tide's gone out. The sea that I swam in a bit earlier has completely disappeared. And now there's a quarter of a mile of sands and rock pools and seaweed between me on the beach and where the breakers are. You might be able to just about hear them. The wind's dropped. When I turned up here, it was quite a stiff breeze and the windsurfers were out. They were going for it. They were really flying. And I was watching them and at some moments the whole windsurfer, like the board and the sail and the person sailing it, be in the air. The only thing that was in contact with the sea was the little tail fin, the keel, the little thing at the back that stuck down off the surfboard. And that was the only thing that was contacting the water. And that looked totally exhilarating. Flying, basically, above the sea on a windsurfer with only a tiny portion of your windsurf board in contact with the water. And then a little bit up the coast, the kite surfers came out and they were flying too. I mean, they were actually flying like completely in the air. So it's really the place for water sports here. Anyway, I'm sitting down in the sand dunes. I'm surrounded by the kind of dune ecology euphorbias and sandy thistly things. And I've had a half a bottle of wine, and I'm in a mood to ruminate. And I don't know if you're interested in my ruminations, but you're going to get them anyway. I want to ruminate about distance, because today I had to ride about 40 kilometres, maybe a little bit less. And somehow it managed to take up the whole day. And it's on an absolutely pan-flat cycleway along the coast, very easy rolling. And somehow it managed to fill up the whole day. Well, not the whole day, because I rolled in here at about 5 o'clock. And if I think about 2 weeks ago, or less than 2 weeks ago, 10 days ago, I was riding a 300-kilometre Audax in the middle of Wales. And that was kind of my distance target, was 320 kilometres to ride in 24, 30 hours, something like that, over seriously hilly and off-road terrain. And that took the whole day. Well, it took the whole day and most of the next day as well. But the point is, whatever distance you set yourself cycling, with the right frame of mind, or just with a curious mind, you end up filling up the day. So you can ride 40 kilometres or 400 kilometres and you have a full day on the bicycle. Well, I stopped for a couple of swims, I had a long lunch, I had an ice cream, I looked around some places along the way, I didn't ride too fast, and you know, the hours went by. The second thing I want to ruminate on is traffic-free cycling. So the last couple of days that I've been riding down the Vendée coast has been almost entirely on traffic-free cycle routes. Really lovely, wide, smooth, either tarmac or a kind of hard, compacted, very fine gravel and sand mixture that, unless it gets really wet in a storm, is, you know, great surface to ride on. And it just made me realise how much of a difference it makes to be completely away from motor vehicles. It completely changes your relationship with the idea of making a journey by bicycle, because it only takes one bad encounter with a motor vehicle, a car, a lorry, a bus, whatever it is. Someone coming a little bit too close, someone not seeing you or not looking at a roundabout, and that kind of near miss situation, for it to really reset your mental stability and your tranquility, and for you to think, what am I doing this for? I almost died there. And it takes a while to get over something like that. So on this sort of route, which is entirely traffic free, easy to navigate, there are these little green signs saying Vendée Vélo this way, telling you how many kilometres you've got to get to the next major town. It's just so easy and it's just wonderful. It means you can just completely tune out of that whole traffic management mentality that we most of the time have on our bicycles. And also, you get a completely different kind of person riding a bike. I mean, this is obvious since it's something that we talk about an awful lot in Britain. If you build it, a whole different set of people will come. And I've seen so many different kinds of people riding along this cycle path. But one little vignette sticks in my mind. And I was riding along and there were these two girls in front of me. They must have been 5 years old, 5 or 6. And they were riding, or maybe even a bit younger, 4 or 5. And they were riding these identical, ridiculous pink and white bicycles with white tyres and a funny little bucket at the back to carry something. Silly little child's bicycles. And they were racing along and they were giving it everything they had. Their elbows were pointing out, their heads were down, and they were just spinning the pedals like as fast as they can, racing along behind their dad. And it was so sweet. And it was just wonderful to see them express their desire to race and to speed along. And we were riding along quite a main rural road where there were cars going along at about 60 or 70 kilometres an hour, but we were on a completely separated cycleway that was entirely segregated. There was a great big verge with trees in it between us and the cars, and the cycleway was 4 or 5 metres wide and a very good surface. As I passed them, I just thought, you are just having the most wonderful experience. You're certainly not thinking about it in the way that I'm thinking about it, as traffic-free cycling. You're just racing along behind your dad and having a wonderful time. And I guess this is maybe a good moment to talk about the other cyclist that I've seen on this Vélo d'Essai route along the Atlantic coast. It's not the school holidays, so there haven't been a huge number of children, actually, although it's a perfect route for cycling with kids. There have been a lot of older people, people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and a lot of them are on electric bikes, which is great because they're getting out and enjoying a little bit of extra help. I've seen some cycle tourists with big panniers, and I saw a couple of what must have been long-distance cycle tourists who particularly stick in my mind. They were young women, I guess 20-somethings, sort of dreadlocked, looked a bit hippie-ish. They weren't wearing any kind of technical, sporty clothing. And one of them's bicycle was completely panniered out. It had Ortliebs front and rear matching set with all the gear, obviously. And the other one just had an enormous bin bag, a black plastic bin bag filled with camping gear, sleeping bag and everything, strapped on the back with a whole bunch of bungees. And as I was cycling along, I realised that these people weren't people who, like me, have a profound disagreement with the politics of the motor car and the internal combustion engine. People who have a strong sense of moral outrage when we see how the motor car has changed the way we live and has changed the places we live in. They were just people who decided that a bicycle is a way of travelling that is faster and easier than going on foot. They were in the open air. They were smelling the beautiful pine scent of the forest. They were carrying their shopping back to their house or their campsite or wherever they were. They were just people using the bicycle, this incredibly simple, overlooked piece of technology, as a way of getting from here to there that is much more pleasant than a car and is much faster and easier than walking. And if you provide a safe, direct and pleasant way for people to travel like that, they'll do it. Whether they're French, whether they're Dutch, whether they're English, whether they're American, Australian, wherever they're from, that's what they'll do. Build it and they'll come. The third thing on my list of ruminations is my bike. So the third thing I want to ruminate on is my bicycle, the bicycle I've been using on this trip, which is my trusty old Brompton. It's not a bike that I ride very often. If you don't know a Brompton, it's a folding bicycle. It's probably the best folding bicycle in terms of the ease of folding into a very small package. And the advantage of that kind of bike, the advantage of a Brompton for this trip, is that you can check it in on the aeroplane as a piece of check-in baggage. You don't have to register and pay for it as a bicycle. It also means you can put it on a train easily without a reservation, or take it on a bus or a taxi. If you've got some kind of insurmountable mechanical trouble, you can always have a get out of jail free card by putting it in the back of a taxi. You can entertain local people you meet by folding it up and unfolding it and looking at their expressions of amazement as it compresses to this tiny package. But ultimately, it's not a particularly fast or nice bike to ride. It does feel like a bit of hard labour pedalling it along. And that just made me feel like I'm really soft. And look at Dervla Murphy, who cycled to India on a single-speed step-through shopping bike in the 1960s, and that I ought to toughen up a bit and think a little bit less about the bicycle that I'm riding. But it also made me feel how spoiled we are with good bicycles, and actually how much easier it is to cover big distances when you're on a bicycle that really fits your body and fits your pedaling action. So, you know, you have a lot of efficiency and you just can cruise along and the miles just disappear. On the Brompton, you're sort of bouncing along because it's got a little bit of suspension in the back and you are feeling as though you're earning every kilometre that you're riding. Having said that, it's a miracle of of miniaturization of the bicycle. And I don't think I'd be able to do this trip without it, actually. Well, you stuck with the ruminations. Well done. I think that's about it for me tonight. The sky is turning a purpley pink shade. The sun has definitely gone down. And they're starting to turn on a few lights in the little village here. So tomorrow I've got to make for the stage finish of this stage one of the Tour de France, which is inland. It's in a town called Fontenay-le-Comte. It's bound to be a sprint finish. I'm not going to stand much of a chance on my Brompton, but it means I've got to say goodbye to this beautiful coastal route, the Vélo Odyssée, the Eurovélo long distance route, which carries on down to La Rochelle and all the way through the southwest of France to the Spanish border. I would love to just keep on riding, I have to say, but that's not to be. I've got to make for Fontenay-le-Comte, which means I've got to go inland and discover what the Vendée away from the coast is like.
Went to the radio interview, ended up alone at the microphone. Get out of town. I think I'll get out of town. Get out of town. I think I'll get out. Sticks with my bus and friends. I follow the road, no, I don't know where it ends. Get out of town, get out of town. I think I'll get out of town. Cause the world turn. I don't want to see it turn.
So for my last glimpse of the Atlantic Ocean, I'm looking out onto the Île de Ré, which is another of these sand spit islands that jut out into the Atlantic. And just offshore from where I'm standing now, there is a huge forest of poles poking out of the sea, about a metre high each one, and they are all indicating the places where mussel ropes are attached. This is obviously a big mussel growing area. It's low tide now, and so there are people heading out, bonjour, to collect coquillage from the beach with their little shovels and rakes and their buckets. Something tasty for lunch, perhaps. And this is also the site I've just discovered of a tragic event in the Second World War. In July 1941, a Royal Air Force Halifax bomber came down here, presumably on the land or in the sea. It had a 7-man crew. 4 of them died in the crash, and 3 were taken prisoner. Beside the plaque commemorating the crash, there's another plaque which commemorates the actions and heroism of 2 local French people here who helped the 3 parachutists from the plane to make their escape. Unfortunately, they were captured by the Germans and they were shot the following February. The 3 RAF crew were presumably taken as prisoners of war. So it wasn't always such a peaceful, tranquil spot as it is now. And so my task today is to make it to the finishing line. It'll be a sprint finish in the Tour de France, but I'm going to take things easy. I'm heading across the Marais, and I have to connect with another cycle route in the interior of the Vendée region. So I have a few kilometres to do under my own powers of navigation, which will make a change for the last few days where I've just simply been following these little green signs taking me along the coast. And it'll be interesting to see how the cycling is when I leave the designated cycle routes to make my own way through the interior of the Vendée.
Mm-hmm. way down, way down.
Up lazy river where old mill run. Meet the lazy river with the noonday sun. Linger in the shade of a kind old tree.
Throw away your trouble, dream a dream of me, dream a dream of me.
Up the lazy river where the robin's on. Wakes to bright new morning
as we loaf along.
Blue skies up above, everyone in love. Up the lazy river, how happy we will be. Mama, mama. Oh, up the lazy river, up the lazy river.
Well, it was quite a shock heading inland, saying goodbye to the sea, because suddenly I was in this landscape of industrial arable farming. Just enormous fields. Wheat, sunflowers, or maize. Very straight roads. Nothing to see, really. Just gigantic corrugated steel barns. And it's a really desolate landscape. And I just wondered, what on earth is this countryside? This place is just, there's nothing here. There's no trace of any kind of history before industrial agriculture. And usually when you're cycling around the countryside, even if it is a place that's now given over to modern methods of farming, you can detect little remnants of the time before the 1960s and 1970s, older houses, bits of woodland, a road with a bend in it. I mean, just little things like that. But here there was nothing. So anyway, I made my way inland and joined up with the route of stage one of the Tour de France. And there's a very obvious way you can discover that you're on the route without even looking at the map. It's that all the villages have got out their old knackered old bicycles, painted them up, covered them with plastic flowers, painted them green, yellow, white with red spots. And there are floral displays. There are great bales of straw set up as giant effigies of bicycles. There are banners out welcoming the Tour de France. And a lot of the roads have either had a fresh coat of tarmac or are about to have a fresh coat of tarmac. So the riders in the Tour can zip along at top speed. It's really nice to see that every year villages around France get in the mood waiting for the Tour, because when the Tour does come through, it's just a few hours, really. Sometimes there may be a little bit of a festival the night before, something going on in the morning, then the roads close, people come out of their houses, the excitement builds, people are trying to find out what's going on in the race, they stand behind the barriers on the corners, then the caravan publicitaire comes through, then the police outriders, and then whoosh, the peloton goes past and it's gone and it's all over. So on my way, I've called in at a village called Chalais-les-Marais, and there is a museum which has really answered my questions about the nature of this landscape. And it turns out that this whole area, the Marais Poitevin, is land that's been reclaimed from the sea over about the last 1,000 years, starting with medieval monks and the abbeys around here, just like the Somerset Levels. It's the same kind of landscape. It was inundated by the sea and then reclaimed slowly by clever monks and abbots who wanted to farm the lands here, to raise livestock, to fish, to hunt for birds. And more latterly, it's been turned over to cereal cultivation. There are some enormous dikes enclosing the marshes, and there's a whole system of canals and sluice gates to manage the water flow, which comes from the rivers upstream of here and empties out into the sea, and also to protect the land which lies below sea level, some of it, from inundation during storms in the winter from the sea. It's a fascinating history of how this land has been managed. And one thing that does seem to be different from the way the Somerset Levels was managed is that even quite recently, there was a bunch of people called Hutiers who lived in little huts, and they scraped out a subsistence existence doing a bit of small-scale farming of livestock, a bit of hunting, a bit of fishing, a bit of coppicing small pockets of woodland. And they got around on foot, wearing clogs, and also by boat, these flat-bottom boats on the canals. And these people were around until right up until the 1960s and 70s, which is an extraordinary thought. There are not many trees around here, so the fuel that they would have used to cook and to keep warm is cow dung. Just a completely different style of life from anything you can imagine, and just a matter of a couple of generations ago. And the museum explains how the process of land reclamation has been progressive over the centuries, with the most recent bits of reclamation, the bits of land nearest to the coast now, have been reclaimed in the 1960s and 70s. And that explains why there's no trace of life before that time, because before that time, it was under the sea, or it was an uninhabited salt marsh. Really interesting. And now I've come inland a lot more and picked up the course of the Vendée River, which is a slow, lazy, meandering river. And that river flows through Fontenay-le-Comte, about 10 kilometres upstream of where I am now. And of course, this being the Vendée, there's a fabulous cycleway beside the river, which is either completely traffic-free, a nice gravel track, or a tarmac road which is open to cars, but there's nobody driving along it. So it's really very, very tranquil and lovely. Coming inland a bit, we're starting to get a few small hills, which I have to say, although it's a bit of a hassle to have to pedal up them, it's quite nice to have a bit of vertical, to be able to see a little bit further, to just get a sense of the landscape in three rather than two dimensions. And as well as the hills around here that have started to appear, there's some old trees, there are roads which don't go just in straight lines, the villages are a little bit older. It's getting more into a sense of the countryside. And it's a beautiful place and very, very empty compared to the coast. And it's only a matter of a few kilometres away from the coast. It's only a couple of tens of kilometres away from the coast, and it's really a different kind of place. If you're into the classic idea of the French countryside with little chambres d'hôtes, B&Bs or gîtes that you can stay in, this is a much better bet of a place to be than right on the coast, where things are a little bit more touristique, if I can put it diplomatically. So I've got about 10 kilometres left to do. I'm not on the Tour de France route anymore. The races in the Tour de France will be on a very fast straight road, and they will be picking up speed now with just 10 kilometres to go. The lead out trains will be getting themselves organised, and the pace of the peloton will pick up ready for the sprint finish. So I'm going to try and do a little bit of a sprint finish in order to make it to Fontenay-le-Comte in time to have a bite of lunch.
Bien savoir pourquoi y a des gens qui restent à Paris, tout ce qui fait si chaud, moi tout, mais c'est merveilleux le mois tout, et je ne connais rien de plus beau qu'un dimanche près de l'eau. Aimez-vous les moules marinières, la friture des petits restaurants? Aimez-vous voir sur la rivière glisser doucement les chalands, sur la Seine ou l'Oise légère, ou bien sur la Marne à nos gens? Aimez-vous les moules marinières arrosées d'un litre de vin blanc?
I made it. I'm at the finishing line of the first stage of the Tour de France, or what I take to be the finishing line of the first stage of the Tour de France. It's kind of hard to tell, but there are lots of placards along this road saying arrivé, and lots of Tour de France stuff in evidence. Buntings out, lots of painted bicycles, and I think this has got to be the place. There's a very long straight road with a slightly uphill finish, and that may be a problem for some of the sprinters, because definitely there's a little kick at the uphill bit, so they're going to need to time their sprint carefully. The way into Fontenay-le-Comte was very pleasant along the Vendée River, and that had a very nice feel to it, just riding along this very lazy river, which lends its name to the whole département here and plays such an important role in the marsh landscape that I've been travelling across since leaving the coast behind. And the town itself, well, it's a sort of small to medium-sized provincial town. It's got a few nice buildings. I think it grew up around the leather industry in medieval times. I guess there was a lot of cattle around here, and it's got some nice buildings beside the river. One very long high street, which I thought initially was going to be where the finish was, but then realised it was a bit too narrow. And I inquired with the woman who ran the bar where I had my lunch if it was the finish. She said, no, you've got to go up there to the main road. I'd been riding along promising myself a steaming bowl of moule marinière with frites and a beer to finish my ride, but there was nowhere. First of all, I was after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so a lot of places had shut for lunch, and doesn't seem to be a moule place here. We're a bit too inland, and I'm kind of kicking myself because there was moule available all the way along the coast, and I think I was a bit preoccupied with getting as many oysters and langoustine as I could. So I missed out on the moule. So I've done this ride in 3 days, and I've definitely gone a bit further than the 200 kilometres that the racers will do, because I've taken this circuitous and mostly traffic-free route along the coast. But I have to say, I have had much better scenery than what they're going to have traipsing along the departmental roads. Not that it's unpleasant what they'll see, but I've had an absolute blast. They will enjoy closed roads because it's the tour, but I definitely wouldn't want to ride the route that they're doing on any normal day, because there's just far too much traffic. But I've enjoyed closed roads, effectively roads that are closed all the time to motor traffic, for I would say 80 to 90% of my journey, which I have to say is absolutely fantastic. And the 10 to 20% where there was traffic was completely chilled out, either an utterly deserted rural road or a narrow road through a small village or town centre where everyone's going really slowly anyway. So for traffic-free, pleasant, stress-free, danger-free cycling alongside some of the most beautiful beaches in Europe, if not the world, then this is the Vendée Coast. I'll definitely be back. Thanks for riding with me. Until next time, goodbye. I hope you enjoyed that extended edition of The Bike Show. And I wasn't primarily out there for The Bike Show. I was writing a piece for The Guardian newspaper, and I'll put a link to that on The Bike Show website, which has a little bit more practical information about getting out there if you want to go and do a ride like that yourself. And I'd like to say now thank you very much to Vendée Tourism for their hospitality. I met with a number of their representatives in different places that I cycled through, and I'm grateful for their help. And I'm also grateful to Vendée Tourism for flying me and my Brompton out there and helping me out with food and lodging along the route.